Hijacked, A Beechwood Adventure by G. Michael Smith. Chapter 28, Escaped. The car started to move. The trunk vibrated as the car accelerated. Billy gagged at the smell of the old blanket covering him. He forced himself to breathe slowly. His heart rate slowed, and he took stock of his situation. His hands were crossed over each other and wrapped in duct tape. All he could move was the index finger of his right hand. He lifted his arm to his face and started to wiggle his one movable finger under the duct tape that was over his mouth. Soon he was able to draw air through his mouth. His sense of being suffocated ebbed. He knew he had to get his hands free first. He lifted his knees up to his chest and then straightened his legs out. His runners caught on the blanket and pulled it off his head. The air was suddenly cooler, and Billy sucked it in greedily through a small opening under the tape. He reached his hands up and felt the trunk lid, hoping to find something sharp to cut the tape. If he could get his hands free, he might be able to escape. If he didn't, he would be at the mercy of these men, and he suspected they had no mercy for anyone, especially a witness to their crime. But he found nothing. Billy kicked his feet up at the trunk lid. They hit with a resounding thud. "Stop thumping around in there, kid, or I'll wrap you up like a mummy," shouted the voice of the fake cop. Billy stopped. He pushed out of his mind the panic that was threatening to overwhelm him and bring tears to his eyes. He knew he had a small jackknife in his back pocket, but there was no way to reach it. He brought his knees up to his chest and reached down with his taped hands. He felt the tape around his ankles. Most of it was sticking to his high-top running shoes and the top of his jeans. He wiggled his feet in the hope he could get his feet free. He was not sure that that would help him, but it was a start. An idea jumped into his mind, and he started to use the one free finger to undo the snap on his jeans. He released it after some effort. The zipper was easier, and it opened slowly. Billy was going to take his pants off, and with them would come his shoes. He could then get the jackknife he always carried in his back pocket. Billy was very conscious of noise. He did not want to give the men any reason to stop and check what he was doing. He wiggled and wormed and undulated his body until he was able to pull his legs out of his shoes and jeans. He was breathing hard. The sweat was dripping down his face. He had also freed almost all of his fingers of his right hand. His thumb was another matter. It was still firmly locked beneath the tape. Once his pants were off, he searched for the knife. He felt it through his jeans, along with the black Sharpie. He got the knife out of his jeans back pocket and worked the blade up and began to cut away the tape holding his hands. Suddenly, they were free. He pulled off the remaining tape from his hands and mouth. A cell phone chimed. He froze and listened.
"Yeah," said the man with the toque. "Okay, we're heading north. Let us know when the truck passes you and we'll cross over and come up behind it."
"Okay."
"How long?"
10 or 15, answered the other.
Billy picked the tape off his shoes and pants. He wiggled back into his pants and felt for his flashlight, found it, and pulled it out. He turned it on, found his knife, and returned it to his pocket. He swept the inside of the trunk. The blanket was in the way, so he yanked on it. It was caught on something. He yanked harder, and it suddenly came free with a click. Billy's hand slammed back into the side of the trunk with a loud thump.
"Listen, kid,
One more sound out of you, and you'll think that little slap I gave you was just a love tap. The fake cop yelled and chuckled. In a way it was, 'cause I love doing it. I will love to punch you in the face even more. I will love to see that itty-bitty nose of yours crushed under my large knuckles. Billy heard both men laugh. He stopped moving. He was breathing hard and concentrating on slowing it down. He did not want to be punched in the face. Billy lay quiet. He could feel a cool breeze coming into the trunk from somewhere. He twisted his body until he was facing the trunk latch. He pointed his flashlight at it. It seemed to be moving up and down. Billy reached out and touched the trunk just above the latch. He felt the entire trunk start to swing open. Surprised, he grabbed it and pulled it back down. He remembered the click when he yanked on the smelly blanket. It must have been caught in the latch of the trunk, and when he pulled it out, the latch released and the trunk unlocked. He now had a way out of the trunk when the car stopped. If the car ever stopped. Billy remembered the lesson his dad taught him when he got his first skateboard. It had something to do with relativity and inertia. He could not remember how those words fit into the explanation, but he did remember what happened when he first stepped off a moving skateboard. It felt like someone had grabbed both his feet and pulled them out from underneath him. He landed flat on his face. But that was when he was 8. He figured jumping out of a moving car would be a heck of a lot worse. He had to wait until the car stopped before he tried to escape. And he had to peek just before he jumped out, so he knew where he was going to run. Jumping out would be a waste of time if he was captured again before he was able to go anywhere. The air rushing past the edges of the unlatched trunk was noisy, but not noisy enough to cover the whispers he could hear from the two men in the car. "Have you decided what we're going to do with our bundle in the trunk?" asked the man in the coveralls. Billy pulled on the trunk to reduce the air noise that whistled in his ears. "We can't let him go." "Oh, I know," said the fake cop. "I'm thinking. After this truck, we'll do something." "What?" "We'll have to head north again. I know this little lake has got a couple of cabins, but no one's staying in them, so I figure we have to make it look like an accident. We'll remove the tape and bang his head on the side of a rowboat, and then we'll take one of the other boats and drag him out to the middle of the lake, dump him into the water, release the rowboat, and paddle back to shore. It'll look like he stole a boat to go for a paddle, fell overboard, bashed his head, and drowned." Billy felt sick. They were talking about murdering him. Billy reached into his back pocket and took out the Sharpie. He was about to write something on the lid of the trunk when he heard the man in the overalls speak. "That lake is at least 10K off the highway. How the heck is a kid like that going to get there? Why would he paddle out into a lake just to fall overboard? Sounds pretty suspicious to me, and I'm not even a cop." "It will be a mystery." Billy could practically hear the fake cop grin. "A mystery that will never be connected to us." "Whatever. Sounds good." Billy stuck his flashlight in his mouth and started to write, "Hijackers, fake cops killed William Braithwaite, 250-555-2143. Drowned me in a lake," he whispered to himself. "The cops will never see this. Shit." He lay back and breathed slowly. Suddenly he sat up and nearly bashed his head. Rolling over to the trunk latch, he opened the trunk just enough to slip his hand out. He reached down and traced the letters and numbers of the license plate of the car. As each was revealed, he repeated it in his head. He closed the trunk, rolled over on his back, pulled up his shirt and wrote on his chest, "I was murdered. TGD 3UE.
Look in trunk. Hijackers. He pulled his shirt down again. At least now his body held clues what they did to him and would maybe lead to their capture. Billy laid back. He was caught between acceptance of his fate and the need to find the way out of his predicament. He heard a cell phone ring and the fake cop answered it.
Yeah, said the cop.
Great. The car began to slow. Billy tensed his muscles in case he got an opportunity to jump out and run. The car stopped, and Billy sat up, pressing his hand to the top of the trunk. It opened slightly. Billy was about to slip out when lights hit him, lights from oncoming traffic. He felt a whoosh of diesel-laden air as a semi sped past. At the same time, the car started after the truck. Billy was flung back into the trunk floor with a thump.
"Stay back. There's no need to get close until it's time to pull him over," said one of the men.
"Yeah, okay. I'll turn on the lights when he approaches the curve. He'll have to pull into the inside of the highway, because there's no room on the other side to park his rig. If he doesn't slow, I'll turn on the siren and force him over."
Billy waited and listened. He felt the car slow. He lifted the trunk lid slightly and saw the blue and red flashes of light coming from the ghost car driven by the hijackers. They had doubled back to the median where they'd thrown him in the trunk. The car stopped, and he heard one door open. He re-ran their procedure over his head. First, the fake cop gets out and approaches the driver whose door is facing the median, concealing him and the cop from any observers. The cop then hits the driver and injects him with something. He returns to the cop car and signals the man in the coveralls to drive the truck. Billy figured that the best time to go will be when both the hijackers are at the truck. Billy counts silently, starting when he heard the second car door open. He got to 13, and he opened the trunk just enough to slip out. He crouched down on the wet pavement. He peeked around the end of the car and saw the man in the coveralls climb into the cab of the semi. The fake cop had his back to him. He was about to run when he realized he did not have any shoes on. He opened the trunk and reached in to grab them. He found them both and slipped one on. He was about to put the other shoe on when he felt a slight gust of wind. The trunk lid swung all the way open with a thump.
"What the hell?"
shouted the fake cop from beside the rear of the semi-trailer. Billy started to run in a hop, skip, and jump fashion, carrying one shoe. He reached the edge of the median and turned to run up the rocky grade that led to the cave opening. He could hear a mixture of sounds, the truck engine starting up, the footsteps of the hijacker chasing him, and his own breath rushing in and out of his lungs. His one shoeless foot stomped down on a sharp rock. He winced and hopped over the remaining gravel.
"You're gonna pay for making me chase you, and I mean pay," shouted the fake cop.
The voice behind him was gaining. Billy turned and headed to the cave entrance. He needed to hide, and the only place he could think of was the cave. Suddenly the ground dropped beneath his feet. He was falling into the depression filled with ferns. His bare foot screamed with pain. Billy knew he had cut it on the sharp rocks. He slipped the shoe he was carrying onto his wounded foot. The pain eased. The shoe acted like a bandage. He wiggled into the cave entrance, breathing hard. He feared the man would hear him. He gradually slowed his ragged breathing and looked behind him. The power had come back on, and he could see light. His string of lights was shining behind him, throwing a shadow into the cave opening. The fake cop might see the light and would catch him for sure if he didn't do something. He pulled some of the undergrowth from the depression into the cave opening and sat with his back to it in an effort to block all light from escaping. Then he waited and listened. He could hear the occasional footsteps and breaking branch as his pursuer searched for him in the darkness. A voice, suddenly very close, shouted. It was just at the lip of the depression. Billy suspected the man was standing and looking down into the hole, but could see nothing of the cave entrance.
"Hey, kid, I'll find out where you live."
There was a pause, and then a little further away the man continues.
"I bet you live in Cornboro, or the Glen. There'll be no hiding from me. If you breathe a word of this to anyone, I will find you. And when I do, I will kill you and everyone in your family. I'll shoot your mother in the head. I'll smash your dad's face in. I will save you for last. And you don't want to know what I'll do to you." Bang, bang, smash, smash, stab, stab.
There was no sound for a while. The man was listening and waiting for Billy to move. Billy didn't move a muscle. Billy was waiting for the sound of the car. There was only silence. He waited. The only thing he moved was his eyes. He looked around the cave. His eyes stopped at the gate and the padlock. They drifted to the pile of bricks he had inspected earlier. It shifted to the other rectangular holes. Why were those holes cut so they were almost perfect rectangles in the bottom of the cave wall? His eyes scanned each. They all seemed empty. He could see the light hit the back of all of them, except hole three. Gate key block three. Maybe the block was not referring to a brick, but a block-shaped hole. Still not daring to move, because he knew the fake cop was waiting for him to reveal himself, he could only stare and imagine what the third hole in the brick wall might hold. At least 10 minutes passed. Billy felt his legs beginning to cramp and his foot ache. Then he heard it. The car started. Some gravel crunched beneath its wheels, and it pulled away from the shoulder. Billy shifted to a slightly more comfortable position, but he still waited. It might be a ploy to get him to come out of his hiding place. He listened, but could hear nothing. He moved some brush away from the cave entrance and stuck his head out and listened. He heard a vehicle come down the freeway and drive right past without slowing down. He listened. Then he heard a footstep slip on the loose gravel that covered the incline. The fake cop was back. He must have driven down the road and then doubled back on foot. Billy carefully pulled the brush back into the hole and waited. Billy heard the man mumble. "I guess he hightailed it. He didn't come out of this side, so I bet he headed across the median to Cornboro. That cuts my search in half. I'll be seeing him soon. He can bet on it." Billy heard him stomp across the loose gravel. Then a car door slammed in the distance. The subsequent silence was broken only by the occasional passing car. Chapter 29. Back to Safety. Billy was tempted to go out and make sure the fake cop was truly gone, but decided against it. The hijacker thought he was from Cornboro. He needed to keep it that way. He reached out of the cave opening and dragged even more brush into the hole. He knew he would have to go out of the cave entrance if he was unable to find the key to the padlock. If he had to, he would wait for daylight. It would not be a good idea to fall again, and he was still not positive the hijacker had really left. He turned his attention to the third rectangular hole. This one seemed deeper than the others. He could not see into the shadows deeper than the small beam coming from the light string could penetrate. He felt for his flashlight. It was no longer in his pocket. He must have dropped it in the trunk of the car. He slid across the cave floor and reached into the third hole. It was much deeper than he had expected and seemed to expand the further he reached. He was just able to reach the back with his fingers and arm fully extended. Sliding his hand from the back to the front, he felt the side walls and ceiling. His right hand was able to feel the left side. He turned onto his left shoulder and extended his left arm into the hole and continued to feel. On his second pass from back to front, his fingers touched something. It was half embedded in the wall of the hole. He grabbed it, pulled it out. It was a small, very heavy box, slightly smaller than the pencil box. His heart pounded. This was the key. He was sure of it. He tried to open the box, but it was corroded shut. Billy looked over at the bricks he had searched earlier and saw what he wanted. The rock hammer was lying on the ground where he had dropped it. He gently tapped the box on all sides with the hammer, and finally it popped open. Billy stared at the contents. There were four small, flat, black rectangles that lay like chocolates. Each one had a marking in the center. It was a Chinese symbol that resembled a house. Billy hooked his nail under one of the little bricks that measured about 5 centimeters by 3 centimeters. It came out easily, for it was about 1/2 a centimeter thick. There was another one underneath. He turned it in his hands. It had heft. Billy tossed it up and down to get a sense of its weight. He turned the whole box upside down and watched the little bricks fall out. There were 12 in all. 12 heavy little black bricks with a small house stamped into each. Billy started to place each of the bricks back into the box. One of them had fallen further away and struck the rock hammer when it fell. Billy picked it up and saw a glint of yellow on one corner. He scraped at the area with his fingernail. Some black tar-like material came off under his nail. He stared at the golden color where he had scraped, and the realization flooded him. These were little bars of gold. He had found the gold treasure, at least the part that had been left behind. He placed the small bars back into the box. With each bar came a shiver of excitement. He set the box down and continued to search the hole for other boxes. He did not find any. This one must have been missed because it had been embedded in the clay that lined the hole. Billy sat with the box of gold in his lap. He started to fantasize about the gold. Suddenly he shook his head as if to shake away the daydreams he was falling into. He still had to get out of this cave. The best-case scenario would be to find the key, open the barred door, lock it behind him, and head back to the shed. The other option was not one he wanted. He was still afraid the hijacker was waiting for him if he had to cross the freeway. He went back to the holes in the walls. He felt inside all of them in turn. The very last one was small and shallow. He felt inside it with his fingers tracing any ridges and indentations. The back of the hole was hard, too hard for the clay that lined the other holes. He reached for his hammer and tapped the back of the small brick-sized hole. It was harder, emitting a thunk at each tap. Out of curiosity, Billy picked up one of the clay bricks that he had inspected earlier and tapped it with his hammer. It sounded exactly the same as the back of the small hole. He swung the hammer hard at the side walls and the corner of the small hole, and discovered the back wall was a brick. He pulled it out and felt behind it. There was nothing. He tapped the brick again and listened. He tapped one of the other bricks and listened. The one from the hole sounded hollow compared to the others. Billy set it down, lifted the hammer, and smashed the hollow-sounding brick dead center. Nothing happened. He picked it up, shook it, and pulled at it. Suddenly something gave way, and he was sitting with a half a brick in each hand. The brick halves fit neatly together and had come apart. An old brass key lay sitting in his lap. He had found it. Billy quickly got to his feet and crouched over the lock on the gate. The key fit perfectly into the lock. He tried to turn it, but it would not budge. He tapped the lock with his hammer and tried to turn the key at the same time. Gradually it came free, and the lock clicked. Billy pulled on the base, and the shackle slowly cleared. He turned it to one side and lifted it from the hasp. He pulled on the gate. The hinges protested, screeching with each movement. Billy froze at the thought that he might be heard by the hijacker waiting above. He decided that he must be ready to open the gate, slam it shut behind him, and snap on the padlock. He picked up the box of what he now referred to as his chest of black gold, the hammer, the key, and the padlock. He slipped them all through the gate. He repiled the bricks and put the key brick back in its place in the small hole. He inspected the floor. It was covered with his footprints. Grabbing a small fern that was sticking out of the cave entrance, he used it to sweep all traces of his trespass from the floor, then scanned his work for indications that someone had been in the cave recently. Feeling satisfied that anyone who found this cave would think they were the first in a very long time, he swept the floor beneath his feet with the fern, erasing the remaining footprints. He pulled open the gate that gave one short, loud squeal, stepped through, and closed it again to another squeal. He attached the lock and snapped it closed after freeing up the inside works by twisting and turning the shackle. The floor of the shed side of the gate was rock and left no trace of anyone passing. He picked up the box of gold, slipped the hammer into his belt, put the key in his pocket next to his knife, and picked up the end of the string of lights. He unscrewed the last bulb in the line a half turn to extinguish it, coiled the cord over his shoulder, and proceeded down the tunnel towards the shed. As he came to the next lit bulb, he did the same until he reached the ladder under the shed. Billy had never been happier to see the ladder. It was like a pathway out of hell. It beckoned him, each rung more attractive than the previous. He proceeded to erase all trace that he had been down the tunnel. He removed the cords, ladder, and rope, and closed the trap door on the shed for the last time. He had no idea what time it was, just some time in the middle of the night. He looked himself over. He was sweaty and dirty and sore. It seemed like everything was hurting. He would go home, sneak into the house. His dad slept like death. Billy shook his head. He did not want to think of death. His dad slept so deeply you could not wake him unless you jumped on him. The thought made Billy smile. He had often jumped on his sleeping dad when he was little. That almost always ended up in a wrestling match where his dad would tickle him until he cried, "Uncle." He would sneak in, clean himself up, and crawl into bed. When his dad asked him about camping, he would say that the storm had scared all the gang, so he canceled the sleep out and sent them home. In a week, the lie would look like the truth. Billy decided he would have to think seriously about not telling any more lies. The hijackers would not come up. He would not tell a soul. As for the gold, well, that would be his secret, and it might come in handy sometime down the road. Chapter 30. Nearly all is exposed. Billy slipped into the house, cleaned up his hands, face, and foot. It was bleeding a little, so he wrapped it in toilet paper and went to bed. His dreams were filled with multi-headed monsters that threatened to kill him and all his family if he did not do their bidding. He woke to his father throwing clothes at him.
"Get up, Billy. I figured you might give up on the sleepover after the storm started."
Billy moaned.
"Get up. It's Saturday, laundry day. Bring all your dirty clothes out. PDQ.
Billy groaned again. "All right, you can sleep a little longer. You worked really hard this week." His father started to pick up all his clothes. He looked at Billy half covered with blankets.
"Take off that T-shirt. It's filthy."
He reached down and pulled a half-sleeping Billy to a sitting position and pulled his T-shirt up and over his head. Billy flopped back down on his back and moaned.
"Oh, let me sleep just a little longer."
Billy could feel his dad staring down at him. Suddenly, Billy was awake with the realization that his father was reading his chest. He quickly turned over and pulled his pillow over his head. There was a long silence that was broken by Billy's father.
"William, please turn over and tell me what the heck. I was murdered, TGD3UE, look in the trunk, hijackers, means, and why it's written on your chest in felt pen."
Billy felt the blood drain from his face, as if it were trying to escape what was coming. He scrambled for a lie to make the words on his chest reasonable and logical. There was nothing. There was less than nothing. It was like the last strand holding him together had suddenly snapped and his whole being was flooding out. Billy sat up and the tears flowed down his face. He had no words. In place of words were sobs carrying great gouts of sound without meaning.
"William, what happened? Tell me. I can help. I can make it all better. I know I can. Tell me, are you all right?"
He pled and looked more carefully at Billy. He saw his foot wrapped up in toilet paper and took it off. He inspected his foot.
"This cut is very bad. You'll need stitches."
He grabbed Billy, held him until he stopped sobbing, and kept repeating that everything would be all right. The fear slowly ebbed, and Billy pushed away from his father.
"I'm okay, Dad," he said.
"Good," replied his father. "Now get up and get dressed, have breakfast, and tell me what happened." Billy sat at the breakfast table, and his dad sat a pile of steaming hot blueberry pancakes down in front of him. Billy looked up.
"I didn't know you could make pancakes," he said with a smile.
"It's a well-guarded secret," said his dad with a grin. "Now eat and tell me what happened last night." Billy started with the secret passage over the maple tree up to the fort, up the cedar tree on the Cooper property. He told him about finding the buckle with the skeleton and finding the tunnel and the cupboard in the cellar that opened on the bricked-up passageway. He told his dad how the buckle with the Chinese lettering had led him to the trap door in the shed and how he had opened it. He explained the lights he had connected in the tunnel and the gate and the lock and crossing the freeway at night to look for the key to the lock. He explained all of what he had done without telling his dad about the hijackers. "William, that does not explain what happened," said his dad. "I know," said Billy, feeling a great relief in sharing his adventures. "There's more. Jackie and I spent the first night in the tree fort. We saw some cops pull over a semi on the freeway. The cops acted strange. We realized that they were not real cops. They had an unmarked car, and they pulled over a big rig carrying valuable cargo and hijacked it. We were afraid adults would not believe us and would take away our secret treehouse, so we didn't say anything. We tried to get evidence to show you after the summer was over by setting up a motion-activated camera to record another hijacking. Jackie borrowed a camera from his dad, but his dad found out it was missing and made him return it. He got grounded because of it. Please get to how and why you cut your foot and wrote that on your chest. Well, I kind of forgotten about the hijackers. I didn't tell Jackie about the secret tunnel. I wanted to keep it for myself. After going to the university and hearing about the gang of Chinese men and how they might have used the forge to melt down their stolen gold, I thought there might still be gold down in the tunnel, so I decided to find it myself. His father nodded. There was a slight hint of a smile at the corner of his mouth, but it was soon replaced by a stern frown. "I couldn't find the key to the gate, so I figured it had to be on the other side. I told you I was going to camp out with the gang, but I went by myself and hid in the shed. I turned on my light string and went over the freeway to find the other end of the tunnel and maybe find the key and the gold. I was looking for the opening on the median when I heard a semi stop and saw flashing police lights. I went to look, but as I was peeking out of the bushes, I slipped and fell. That is when the hijackers caught me and threw me in the trunk of their car." Billy stared at the look of horror on his father's face. He continued, I heard them plan to kill me by hitting me on the head and drowning me in the lake, so I wrote a message in the trunk and wrote this note on my chest so whoever found me would know I had been murdered." His dad was wide-eyed, shocked at the thought. Billy filled in all the details of his time in the trunk of the car, his escape and his finding the key to the lock in the cave. Billy felt so good to finally be telling someone. He even smiled as he explained cutting the tape from his hands, running away, and cutting his foot. Billy's dad did not scold or chastise him for his bad choices, but Billy knew that would come later. He was going to have to pay for not telling his father. It would not be pleasant, but it would be fair. Billy would accept whatever punishment his father decided. As far as the hijackers were concerned, Billy would spend 3 hours explaining to the police everything he had seen. The license plate number he had written on his chest was the most important piece of evidence. The real police found the fake cop car. In the trunk was the note Billy had written. That enabled the police to get search warrants for a number of properties, and the hijackers were arrested. There was never any mention of Billy's name during the trial. His name and phone number were redacted from the evidence given at the trial. He would be safe from any of the hijackers ever finding out his identity. There was only one thing he held back. He simply left it out, rationalizing that it was okay to omit a small detail from the story, one that wouldn't hurt anyone. So he kept it to himself. The omission was easy to maintain. Concealed under a loose floorboard in his bedroom was a small box with 12 gold bars painted black, with a Chinese house marking imprinted into each one. Billy looked up the symbol on his dad's computer. The symbol was the Chinese word for gold. He erased his browsing history from his dad's computer. The end. Hijacked can be purchased on Amazon and other online booksellers. The second book, titled The Green Dragon, featuring Billy Braithwaite, is coming soon.